Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a plane crash in Statesville leads to a death in the NASCAR family, and former Governor Jim Hunt also dies, not in the crash. The fallout continues after the arrest of the co-owner of Sycamore Brewing for the alleged rape of a 13-year-old girl. Questions over Border Patrol continue, though they appear to have ended Operation Charlotte's Web. Sheriff McFadden says you have to pay attention to how they worded their exit.
That means to me that you probably will be back.
After years of work and lobbying Congress, it appears the Lumbee tribe is headed for official recognition, and State House member Carla Cunningham, who made widely criticized and seemingly racist statements this summer on the floor of the House, works to change her image in advance of a primary.
I want to make it clear, I am not a bigot.
Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. Mary C. Curtis is with her. She's a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Well, yesterday afternoon, we found out that former retired NASCAR driver Greg Biffle, his wife Christina, his two children, Ryder and Emma, along with Dennis Dutton and his son Jack and Craig Wadsworth, died in a fiery plane crash at Statesville Regional Airport. They were flying on a Cessna Citation, a business jet that Biffle's company owned, as far as we know. The plane's flight plan indicated it was bound for several locations in Florida before it was scheduled to return to Statesville last night. I read conflicting reports, Joe, that this plane crashed on takeoff, and then I read a report that it crashed on landing. So what did happen? What do we know about this?
It crashed on landing. It started at 10:15. That's when the call came in. The plane was only in the air for a matter of minutes, I would say maybe 10, 15 minutes before it started to come back. And the plane crashed upon landing. The conditions at the time were not great. The visibility was poor, only about 5 miles. There was heavy drizzle. And NTSB has arrived and is going to have a press conference this afternoon discussing their findings, initial findings over whether this was a mechanical failure or if there was weather at play or what may have happened during this
crash. I'm assuming that a plane, even though it's a private jet, that seats about seven people and there were seven people on board, I'm assuming that it has a black box. Have they recovered a black box? Did we know?
I assume it does. I don't know. I do know that there was a fire that broke out after the crash, and some investigators on scene told me that was making things a little harder because of the extent of the damage. But I think NTSB will have a good chance at recovering most of the data.
Greg Biffle was one of NASCAR's 75 greatest drivers, who was also known for his humanitarian and philanthropic work. NASCAR released a statement yesterday expressing their devastation, saying he was more than a champion driver. He was a beloved member of the NASCAR community, a fierce competitor, and a friend to many. And they added at the end that the NASCAR is and always has been a family sport, and we are devastated by this loss. He was added to the list of nominees for induction into the NASCAR Hall of Fame in 2024, and he also did something really special. He took a leadership role in relief efforts in Western North Carolina following Hurricane Helene. He was a certified helicopter pilot. What did he do?
So it's not easy to fly a chopper. He spent all of his money, a lot of money, flying to Western North Carolina to conduct rescues and to provide resources to Western North Carolina when a lot of people were not at the time.
Eli.
And he spent weeks organizing and personally conducting these flights. Some of them involved bringing people out on his helicopter, people who were completely cut off because of the roads being washed away, and others involved bringing supplies in. Just in September, for the one-year anniversary, Greg Biffle actually created and posted a documentary on YouTube detailing his efforts and including footage of these rescues, the helicopter flights, the disaster footage. And I would really encourage people to go. We have it posted on our website or on YouTube, and just see this documentary that he created and posted about this rescue effort, because it is really something.
Yeah, it's always a tragedy when somebody dies, particularly in a plane crash like that. And it's even worse when it's an entire family. He had young children, which is just, it's horrible to contemplate. Governor Josh Stein expressed his condolences at a press conference and said investigating the crash will be a group effort.
The SBI, State Bureau of Investigation, the Highway Patrol, they're on the site. They're working with the FAA. They're working with the local sheriff. So this is, again, a whole-of-government approach, local, state, and federal. And they're going to do everything they can to figure out what happened.
Speaking of governors, former governor, North Carolina governor, Jim Hunt died yesterday. A Democrat, he served for 16 years in non-consecutive terms. He was the longest-serving North Carolina governor. And he convinced the legislature to allow him to run for a second term. He started the trend of governors having a second term in office. He was the 69th and the 71st governor of our state. And Governor Josh Stein said of Hunt, "I can think of no one who shaped North Carolina's recent successes as much as Governor Jim Hunt." Mary, what do you want to add to that?
Well, it's interesting because he was part of that trend, you know, of particularly Southern politicians like the Jimmy Carters that tried to cleave together white moderate voters, because Jim Hunt grew up in the segregated South, of course, and Black voters, which was it was a ticket to success for him in many ways, although, of course, it was used against him when he ran in his Senate race with Jesse Helms. And Jesse Helms attacked him for his support of a Martin Luther King Day holiday. But Jim Hunt appointed the first Black state Supreme Court justice and cabinet member. And although he was an old school politician, let's face it, he used patronage and all of these things, I would say that he also would be known as the education governor because, you know, he started the preschool programs. And remember, the South was very, Southern states were very low when it came to achievement and national achievement and education standards. And he tried to bump that up, bump up teacher pay, things like that. So I think he has a really strong legacy, particularly in Democratic politics in the South, and he had a national reputation. He was a national leader as well. So, you know, there are Democrats who succeeded in North Carolina, in the South, I think owe him a debt.
When he ran against Jesse Helms for United States Senate, Jesse Helms got wind of this early on, and 20 months before the election, he began, Jesse began running negative ads about Jim Hunt. And had Jim Hunt won that Senate seat, it is speculated that he might have gone on to become a presidential candidate because he was that well respected in political circles, not just here in North Carolina, but in Democratic circles nationwide. Eli.
And I think he really set a few templates in that, you know, he kept the governorship in North Carolina in the Democratic Party, even as the state trended redder and redder. He won, you know, an election in which the Democratic presidential candidate, Jim McGovern got, I believe, 29%, but Hunt still won the governorship as a Democrat in North Carolina. And that is a pattern that we continue to see today with Roy Cooper and Josh Stein winning the governorship while North Carolina goes red in the presidential elections. Also, his Jesse Helms campaign was, I think, in many ways, one of the first modern, ultra-nasty, ultra negative campaigns in the modern era, and set the tone and the template for a lot of the races we see now. You know, Governor Hunt said afterwards, reflecting on it, you know, we were naive. We didn't expect that level of vitriol, which has become standard now.
Jim Hunt, all of the living North Carolina governors have had very nice things to say about Jim Hunt over the last 24 hours, including the Republican governors. Pat McCrory referred to him as a big help when he first came to the office and as a kind of a mentor. and Jim Hunt, excuse me, Jim Martin, referred to him as, although they didn't go to each other's rallies and didn't agree with each other's politics, they did work together because they were both respected each other as leaders of North Carolina. And I want to just add that outside of Pat McCrory, Jim Hunt is the one governor who has made himself available to be on programs that I have hosted. Jim Hunt was on with me a lot of times when I was working at WBT, and I want to thank him for that. Of course, the current lieutenant governor, Rachel Hunt, is Governor Hunt's daughter, and the governor, Jim Hunt, died yesterday at the age of 88. Well, the co-founder of Sycamore Brewing, Justin Brigham, is being held, well, first he was being held on $10 million bond. That's since been increased to $11.25 million, and he's been charged with breaking into a Stanley County home and raping a 13-year-old girl. That happened a couple of weeks ago, but the fallout is continuing. What's happening as a result of this?
Well, we continue to see businesses distance themselves and stop carrying Sycamore products. The Charlotte Ledger just reported today that the major distributor in upstate South Carolina just said that they are not going to be selling Sycamore products, and that's the latest blow. In addition to, you know, kind of just the consumer reaction and people, you know, posting social media videos of themselves pouring Sycamore beer out and that sort of thing, losing the distribution networks is really, really significant because, you know, in most states, you are required to sell through a distribution network if you're an alcohol producer. So when they stop carrying products, that is really the total cutoff from any market for Sycamore.
Immediately following his arrest, Brigham divested himself of all ownership in the company. His wife took the leadership role immediately, but that didn't seem to slow the negative reaction to in retail stores that you referred to a minute ago, Eli. Joe, what's happened at their sparkling, bright South End location? Are people coming?
It's pretty crazy. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been there, Mike, on a Friday night, but hundreds of people, mainly 20 to 30 year olds, are packing that place. And last Friday night, there might have been 10. Saturday, Sunday, similar stories. I think over time, crowds will return, maybe not at the level of popularity that it had pre this scandal. Right now, it's just really hard to separate the egregiousness of the charge from the brand, even while knowing that every single person at Sycamore, except for one person, really had nothing to do with this. And, you know, it's going to take time. It's going to take legitimate outreach to the community by the company. And maybe, you know, some people have speculated maybe a rebrand, maybe a fresh start for Sycamore is needed as a result of all this.
Ryan.
Right, and that, like he just mentioned, that Sycamore Brewing location is huge in South End, but it's also important to remember that they were in the midst of constructing another facility in Cotswold, and I've heard reporting saying that that's why they were in town, because they were living outside of the state before then, and had moved back to oversee this construction of the new facility in Cotswold. So I've not heard yet whether or not they're moving forward with that, but it's definitely something that is on her mind now, the new sole owner, in terms of how that's going to move forward.
So I have 20 seconds left. They increased his bond from 10 to $11.25 million. Why?
Because they added 7 more charges that stemmed from the...
Okay, so when we come back, I want to talk about some of those charges and what actually happened, what allegedly actually happened between him and that 13-year-old girl. And there are other things to talk about, which we'll move on to as well. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor of WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Ryan Pitkin is the co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. We were talking before the break about Sycamore Brewing and the fact that Justin Brigham, the former the co-founder, is being held on $11.25 million bond charged with allegedly raping a 13-year-old girl in Stanley County. Joe, you reported on how he met this young woman. How did he?
Yes. So it all started with them meeting on Snapchat. She is 13 years old. He is 44 years old. And they talked for a couple of weeks. And last week, he went to her house in the middle of the night and raped the 13-year-old. While he was in the house, the parents discovered or heard something in her room, discovered him, and placed a 911 call from inside the house. There was a skirmish. The parents were trying to get this naked man out of their house. And there was a fight as a result of it. And during that fight, he is accused of assaulting a relative of this 13-year-old by grabbing and twisting his genitals. The naked man, Justin Brigham, left the house, fled. From my understanding, he left behind all of his clothes with his keys, so he could not get far. And the deputies, when they arrived responding to the 911 call, caught him naked near his vehicle, which he could not use.
Wow. There's a story right there. Is this, I know one of the things that they're trying to determine is if this is a one-off or if this was part of a pattern of behavior, correct?
So that is one of the reasons why they executed a search warrant on his house, because they have now seized all of his electronic devices and they are going through them to determine if there are any other people out there.
Eli.
And given how lurid the details are and how disturbing this crime is alleged to be, I think that points to why you've seen such a vitriolic reaction against Sycamore and this intense backlash. You know, I was trying to parse why it's so intense. And I think a microbrewery is really tied to the founders. And when you look at the, you know, previous coverage, it's all interviews with them. It's very personal. It's wrapped up in their personalities. If this happened with like the CEO of an airline or something like that, I think people would inherently understand, okay, well, that's horrible, but the thousands of pilots aren't direct creations of this airline CEO. With a brewery, the product is a direct creation imbued with the personality of the founders, which I think is going to make it really hard for them to overcome this.
And then, of course, there is the age of the victim. I mean, she's 13 years old, Mary.
Yeah, and people have looked back at, you know, they were in the news before this company because they were famous for having these kind of risque packaging on some of their holiday products, sexually risque, and perhaps that meant nothing, but people are looking at everything that has to do with this company that, as Eli said, it's very personal in how they have been marketed. And even though, you know, Sarah Taylor, his wife, has, you know, been right out front saying he has nothing to do with it, I'm the sole owner, it is really, people realize that this person had nothing to do with this, and they have many employees, of course, that are out of work because of this. But it is such a horrific crime, and as more and more details come out, it gets worse. So people really, you know, Food Lion, Publix, Lowe's, everybody's just taking it off the shelf. They just don't want to be associated with it at all.
Ryan, then Joe.
Right. And as you had mentioned earlier, whether investigating whether this was a one-off or a previous behavior, one thing that makes it tough is, as I alluded to earlier, a source close to the family told me that they were living, before they came back for the Cotswold, construction that they would have been living almost near, I think, full time in Bermuda, where Sarah is from. So that could make it, if there was any activity or a criminal behavior down there, predatory behavior, that could make it very difficult, seeing as how it's not a U.S. territory and it would be an international investigation. All sorts of different difficulties with trying to corroborate that investigation, but it concerns me with what the behavior was there.
Joe.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why he will have to surrender his passport if he bails out of jail, is because of that Bermuda residence, $11.5 million. It's going to be a lot of money he'll have to put up to get out of jail. But that is one of the conditions of release. I'll also just say, you know, Sycamore has taken the step of filing the necessary paperwork with the Secretary of State to indicate that Justin Brigham is no longer a managing member of the organization. From what I understand, though, it is not that simple. There may be some more steps behind the scenes to really get a clean break from him. I'm sure there's a lot of, there's going to be a lot of different factors that they have to consider. And thing, you know, even like as complicated as divorce law, if Sarah wanted to divorce her husband, you know, there has to be a year separation. So there's a lot of different assets at stake here. And then just, you know, going back to the Sycamore angle on this, I've also heard that Justin and Sarah have spent most of their time in Bermuda, and many employees of Sycamore have never even met the two of them. But yet they are the ones who are feeling a lot of the fallout of this because people are no longer going to their brewery. So this is just really a devastating story all around.
I want to wrap this up, but Eli, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Joe said and say anyone who's tried to sell a house or do a big transaction knows you can't just instantly say, like, I am divested and the other person has it. There's a ton involved in selling a business share like that. The other thing I think is important to note is that the beer industry in general is trending down. People are drinking less. Breweries are closing. It's not a boom anymore. So this is a really bad time for something like this to happen to a brewery that is leveraged and trying to expand.
Moving on to a different topic, a church in the Optimist Park neighborhood chose to include ICE agents, figures of ICE agents, in their nativity scene installation, and that has sparked some controversy. First, why did Mission Gathering Charlotte, that's the name of the church, I guess, decide to put up this display? Anybody know?
So Julian Berger, our immigration reporter, has talked to the pastor, and he said that they wanted to prompt conversations and, kind of shock people into thinking about the Christmas story, which features, you know, in many ways a refugee story with Jesus and his relatives, Mary and Joseph, being forced to flee the authorities and live in another land. So they wanted to kind of put this in a modern setting and say, like, okay, if they showed up as refugees today, what would it look like? Would people welcome them, or would they face ICE raids? And he said that they wanted to get people talking and provoke reactions.
These ICE figures are they were posed in such a way that it depicted Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus as targets of ICE. Pastor Andrew Shipley, as you said he wanted to provoke thought through this, and some may have reacted that way, but not all. A week ago, a man pushed the ICE agents in that scene down. He toppled them over. Here's Pastor Shipley.
He left the nativity scene intact, so he almost like showed what we want, right? Which is for these raids to stop, for people to be able to feel secure, and for like us to be able to have the type of Christmas we all want.
So do we know if the person who toppled these figures over toppled them over because he was against ICE, or did he topple them over because he didn't like the depiction that they had displayed in this nativity scene?
I've seen the video, and it looks pretty clear that it was the latter.
Okay. Meanwhile, Border Patrol came to Charlotte just before Thanksgiving and sent the Hispanic community in this area into a tailspin. They came and they operated with little or no contact with local law enforcement, and then they left. Well, Sheriff McFadden said that they were gone. Homeland Security quickly responded that no, we will maintain an ongoing presence. And McFadden says that left him with unanswered questions. He also says that the lack of coordination that Border Patrol had with law enforcement locally raises concerns about transparency, public safety, and accountability. And I ask, isn't that the point? Wasn't that the point of it all?
Absolutely. I think so. It was to, there are still certain businesses along the East Charlotte corridor that keep their doors closed, keep their doors locked one by one entrance to, weeks later after this. It's all to cause sort of a feeling of disarray and mistrust and not wanting and fear mongering, to be honest. I would agree that they want you to think that they'll be back any minute.
Well, McFadden.
Also, economically, those businesses have really been hurt. They're saying that, you know, this has really caused a debt that they haven't seen since COVID because people haven't been coming out. So this is a long lasting effect for all of those businesses.
McFadden, who was among those who said that Border Patrol had gone, told WFAE this week that after conversations with immigration enforcement officials, their work here may not be done.
When CBP left, and me talking to some federal officials, they made the comment that they're finished this year. They're finished for the year. And so when you say you finished for the year, that means to me that you probably will be back.
So Border Patrol ran their shock and awe campaign and then left for New Orleans. They've done something similar in other cities. Have they ever returned to the cities that they vacated?
Yes, just this week, Greg Bovino, the kind of bombastic agent who spearheaded these, was back in the Chicagoland area, posting videos and kind of, you know, going and with another surge of agents there. So I think there's a greatest hits tour where they're going back. But there's also, as Ryan was saying, just a lot of incentive for them to create this ongoing fear and uncertainty where they can make people be afraid and not even have to come back. They can just, create the idea.
Joe.
What I fully agree that it's possible they will come back because Bovino has said, alluded to the fact that we're not done yet. So that tells me that it's possible we'll come back. But I do want to remind people that 2026 is an election year. And in the aftermath of the raids in Charlotte, not all Republicans, but there were Republicans who did interviews and spoke out saying, hey, the way this operation was conducted did not really make us look that great. Just going up to random landscapers in the Myers Park Country Club or putting up Christmas lights. There was reporting on that in Politico. I think there was an editorial in The Observer. These are Republicans who were saying that. And we got Michael Whatley versus Roy Cooper in 2026. And I do think that the political aspect of this, if they think that this could hurt Michael Whatley in any way, maybe North Carolina isn't as much of a priority as, say, a Chicago or a Los Angeles.
Except that normally that would be the case, it seems to me, except that it seems that right now Donald Trump is politically tone deaf. If you listen to his speech on Wednesday night where he denied everything that everybody is experiencing and seeing with their own eyes, this is his baby, this ICE invasion. So will he be politically responsive to that? Mary?
Well, as to follow up on what Joe said, the polls are showing that all the gains they made among Latino voters in the last election, a lot of it is cratering because, you know, a lot of folks felt, well, he doesn't mean me, but it's showing up that they are picking up grandmothers and, you know, random people off the streets, and his support is cratering. So it will be, will Republicans get to him to say, listen, all of these increasingly harsh videos that are coming out. I think the last one was an agent putting his foot on the back of a pregnant woman and people were yelling at them. And it's showing up in the polls. But as you say, Donald Trump is really unleashed at this point. And, you know, he's spending time, you know, writing nasty plaques in the White House as opposed to trying to shore up what's going on in the polls and among his base that, you know, he thought he had all of these voters and he had won over Latino voters. And in fact, that was considered when the Republicans were doing redistricting in states like Texas and North Carolina and other places. So all of these places that he won by maybe 5 or 6 percentage points, it's looking like, you know, maybe he's losing support in these close races. So we'll see if he listens.
They arrested hundreds of people in this dragnet over the course of a week or so without warrants. They whisked them away. Sheriff McFadden says, quote, nobody to this day knows who has been picked up. We can only go on what they're saying, but with no verification. We don't know from the families who was caught up in this. Has anybody been in touch with these people? Have they been able to call their families? Have they been able to call lawyers? Do we know?
We don't know, and they have refused to release the names of those who have been arrested. And
is this Nazi Germany we're living in? Seriously.
You know, we don't have, we've heard from some families and we've reported on some of their stories, but we don't have, you know, the capacity to find 425 plus people ourselves and verify it. And frankly, as long as they choose to conceal this information, you know, there's not a lot we can do to pry it open. They've kind of discovered a loophole. If you just say no or don't respond, then you can't see, but I'm raising my
arms
in a shrug.
Ryan.
I would describe it as shrug emoji by Eli there. I would just think it's important to mention, too, that we are in year one out of four. So discussing them returning is almost certainly a no-brainer just when you think about the fact that this so-called big, beautiful bill made Immigration Enforcement Departments the biggest in the country and raised their budget exponentially. And that hasn't really even taken effect with all the recruiting that they're doing yet and how that money is going to play into the fact that the next we've got 3 years of this, them coming into whatever cities that Trump has problems with.
After a ranting speech on speed on Wednesday night, filled with mistruths, Donald Trump is returning to North Carolina tonight. He's in what will become North Carolina's newly drawn 1st congressional district, which, among others, was redrawn at his request so that it would be more GOP friendly in the midterms. He'll be speaking in Rocky Mount tonight. What will be the topic, one wonders?
Well, he's supposed to be talking about affordability in the economy, but he has not been disciplined about that. He really starts off talking about that, but then he says there is no crisis and that his economy is A++++++. And, you know, Republicans are saying, well, people don't feel that. And then he usually morphs into talking about immigrants as the cause of our problems. Every problem from housing to job insecurities to the economy. My column says, you know, this week that he uses an individual to say everybody's bad.
And that's what autocrats do. We have to take a break. We'll come back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo is with us. He's the senior editor here at WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of the Charlotte Queen City Nerve publication. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Donald Trump will be here tonight in District 1, which is set to be one of the biggest congressional races in the state. In the midterms, Representative Don Davis, the Democrat, is the incumbent there. He will no longer be in that district because he's been moved into District 3, but he's going to move himself into District 1 and run again. And several Republicans have already emerged to run against Davis, including State Senator Bobby Hannig, Carteret County Sheriff Asa Buck, Lenore County Commissioner Eric Rouse, and Attorney Ashley Nicole Russell. Others are rumored to be considering a run. Has Trump picked a favorite among those Republicans yet?
No, not yet. I would keep an eye on Eric Rouse of Lenore County only because Jonathan Feltz is backing his campaign, and Feltz has like a gift to get Trump to endorse his candidates And many times his candidates aren't necessarily someone you have heard of before, like Addison McDowell in the 6th District. So keep an eye on Rouse. I've never met Mr. Rouse. I've never met any of these candidates, but it will definitely be a competitive and interesting Republican primary.
So he has picked one candidate in the Senate race because Michael Whatley, the former state GOP chair, is running to replace Tom Tillis. And, of course, Governor Cooper is running on the Democratic side at the moment. But now another person has thrown their hat into the Republican side of the race, and that is a former Republican candidate for superintendent of education, Michelle Morrow. Remind us who she is.
So Michelle Morrow was, I guess you could say, a firebrand. She unseated Catherine Truitt, the incumbent Republican education secretary in North Carolina, in the last Republican primary. She drew a lot of criticism for previous social media posts and videos she had posted in which she had suggested things like the televised execution of Barack Obama. And she was also outside the Capitol on January 6th, although she says she did not participate in the insurrection itself. So she is, I think, a really a far-right candidate. It will be interesting to see if she can mount a credible challenge to Whatley, who already has the Trump endorsement locked down and has Trump coming to speak on his behalf, you know, about three. It's gosh, we're only 3 months out from the primary. That's scary. 3 months out. And, you know, there's also an element of establishment versus anti-establishment here. She is anti-establishment. That's how she unseated Kathy Truitt. And Michael Whatley, you know, I think the Trump wing has now become the establishment. So even though he might have previously been considered an outsider a decade ago, now he is kind of the establishment candidate.
But also it seems that, you know, Whatley doesn't have a lot of name recognition. And so she does. And so it'll be interesting to see if he will try to paint her as too extreme for the state. And she will say, well, I'm the one standing. I'm, you know, more than one. The person standing up for right wing, you know, conservative values. So, I mean, she was trying to become the head of the schools and she really did not have a good opinion of public schools. She called them, I believe, indoctrination, you know, factories. So we'll see what happens, but it should be interesting.
Just as a side note, this really has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about. I just want to bring it up. The Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. was named yesterday the Trump Kennedy Center. He claims to know nothing about this because he said the board made this decision, but he named himself the chairman of the board. So clearly he's lying. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt announced the decision, praising Trump's role in saving the building financially and physically. So I just want to fact check that for a moment. Because just like the administration's claims about lowering prices and ending inflation, that too is a lie. Subscription revenue at the Kennedy Center, by their own figures, has dropped 38.6% since he fired the former staff that ran the establishment and became chairman of the board. And single ticket sales are down 50%. Moving on. The newly formed Metropolitan Public Transit Authority, which came into being as the result of the sales tax referendum, held its first official meeting last night. It was scheduled to be a light meeting. What did they do, Joe?
It was a light meeting. They elected David Howard, highly qualified person and really knows his stuff, to be the chair of the MPTA. I think they picked well there. He's a former city council member, a longtime transportation official. And they also, they picked like at random who's going to have the four-year term and who's going to have the two-year term because they're staggered terms on the MPTA. And they kind of got an overview from an attorney about what to expect. They didn't vote on a groundbreaking date for the red line. But first meeting, a lot of pomp and circumstance, a lot of housekeeping stuff.
Yeah, the commission, whatever you want to call them, unanimously selected David Howard to lead that body. Howard worked for NCDOT for a while. He was also working with former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox when Fox led the U.S. Department of Transportation. And after his selection, Howard had this to say.
A lot of what we need to do is to make sure that we treat everybody, no matter what part of the community, the same and they have access.
So one of the biggest issues, of course, that they face, this new commission, is safety on transit and the perception of safety on transit. Some were speculating that CATS might form its own police force to that end. Was that discussed?
No, it will be. And I do think that is a realistic possibility. You know, you got MARTA police in Atlanta. Seattle has its own police force. I believe New York City has its own police force as well, or at least NYPD has a transit division. So, big cities are doing this. I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that Charlotte or the MPTA does it as well.
So let's get into the Wayback Machine. Go back to 1994 for a moment. A lawsuit that has come to be known as the Leandro case was filed by low-wealth school districts claiming at the time that the state was not meeting its constitutional duty to provide every child with a sound basic education. The court found in favor of the plaintiffs, but the case has been lingering in the courts for decades. And the central point of discussion now appears to be whether the courts have the power to order the General Assembly to appropriate the necessary funds to meet their constitutional obligations. This week, many were expecting the state Supreme Court to announce a decision in the case. What happened, Eli?
Nothing. Every few months, the state Supreme Court releases a batch of decisions. They all come out, you know, on the same date. And the next one will not be until February, which means that if they release a ruling then on this case, if they do it then, it will have been more than 2 years since the case was argued before the court. So we're guaranteed to be longer than 2 years waiting for a final decision in this much litigated and much appealed case.
So the North Carolina Association of Educators has now accused the court of neglect. Tamika Walker Kelly is the president of that organization.
They made a decision to neglect almost 1.5 million public school children here in North Carolina. They neglected their needs for books and classrooms. They neglected their need for school counselors and nurses in our buildings. They neglected the need for us to have safe buildings, smaller class sizes, and educators who are supported.
So this has been going back and forth like a ping pong ball among democratically controlled Supreme Courts and Republican controlled Supreme Courts. I don't know quite why this has become such a political football, but clearly it is. So now that they punted, speaking of football, are they expected to take this up again next year?
Well, they are not going to have another hearing. They're not going to have more arguments. All we're waiting for right now is for them to rule on the appeal that was heard almost 2 years ago. So that is, you know, it's all been done. All the arguments have been made. We're just waiting for them to say yay or nay. And I think at this point, whatever the direction of the ruling is, there's a strong feeling in the education advocacy community that they just want to know, is this going to be ruled one way or another? Just let it happen.
So if you recall, last summer, Charlotte Democrat Carla Cunningham, a member of the state House, raised some eyebrows after helping Republicans override the governor's veto of an immigration enforcement bill. The eyebrows weren't up just because of that, but also because of what she said.
First, as a people, we need to recognize that it's not just the numbers that matter, but also where the immigrants come from and the culture they bring with them to another country. As the social scientists report, all cultures are not equal.
And she didn't stop there. She went on sharing what she called her unapologetic truth.
Other countries are making it much more difficult to get citizenship. We have been naive. We have been exploited and abused by the different tactics to gain citizenship in America. It's time to wake up.
And she criticized immigrants who were already here for not assimilating, insisting that other countries wouldn't tolerate it, and neither should we.
Some immigrants come and believe they can function in isolation, refusing to adapt. They have come to our country for many reasons, but I suggest they must assimilate, adapt to the culture of the country they wish to live in.
So this was all part of a debate over an immigration enforcement bill. Eli, what was this bill supposed to do?
So this is the bill that Governor Stein had vetoed, which mandates closer cooperation between county sheriffs and ICE. Basically, I would say, kind of standard right now GOP immigration crackdown, make the sheriffs comply bill. Her rhetoric about it was what really raised eyebrows, even more than her vote overriding Governor Stein's veto, because it sounded indistinguishable from the rhetoric you hear coming from the White House, hardliners like Stephen Miller, etc.
Right. And she is known for voting with Republicans more frequently than the rest of her party when it comes to contentious bills. And she didn't have much to say about the comments she made on the House floor once the debate was over until now. Now she has filed for re-election and will likely face a crowded field. And in recent conversation with WFAE and our Steve Harrison, our political reporter, she told him that she would not go back and change her vote, but would have softened some of the language she used.
I want to make it clear, I am not a bigot and I am not anti-immigrant and I never have been. And I understand as an African-American woman what it's like to be discriminated against because I have been.
So Ryan, are these other candidates running against her in the Democratic primary because of these comments that she made or something, just because they want a shot at the office?
First, I just want to say that reminds me of the famous tweet. My I am not a bigot t-shirt is raising a lot of questions that my t-shirt already answers. once you find yourself having to say that in an interview, I would say Reverend Ronnie Sadler is getting a lot of the most attention here, was inspired by this speech and seeing this. He's a Baptist minister who's been part of the progressive movement in Charlotte for a long time, very much in like the Moral Monday vein, I would say. And I ran into him at a protest in Uptown of the CBP presence in Charlotte to tie some stories together. And he was very much speaking about how he wanted to run in part because he wanted to make it clear that he stands with his neighbors who are under attack in this way.
Yeah, he told her before her vote on that bill that it was not an immigration bill. It was a bill, it was not a political issue, but a moral issue, and that it hurt his heart that she refused to give attention to the moral imperatives.
Over and over again, God says that you are to love the alien as you love yourself. Love the stranger as you love yourself. Love those who are from without, who are vulnerable, as you love yourself.
I'm not sure that's a position on immigration that will resonate in North Carolina. Maybe it will. Do you think it will?
Well, regardless of whether it resonates, Reverend Sadler has said he's raised $100,000 already, okay, which is a huge amount for a House campaign. So it clearly resonates with the donors and the people who want to unseat Carla Cunningham. And he has the resources to mount a very strong primary campaign here.
Joe.
Border Patrol's actions didn't help him. Didn't help ICE and the immigration raids. That's going to help him, I think, a little bit.
Joe.
Sadler is a strong candidate. Got a boost by Morris McAdoo saying he isn't going to run in this race. He's running for Mecklenburg County Commission. Instead, I will remind people, though, that Carla Cunningham is a longtime incumbent. She has a record. She has secured projects and funding for her district because of her willingness to be bipartisan. And it will be interesting to see who weighs in on this race, including Governor Josh Stein.
So the Panthers, you may have heard, they lost last weekend. They had a 10-point lead and then lost on a last-second field goal to New Orleans. That makes the road to the playoffs a little more difficult, but head coach Dave Canales seemed undaunted after that game and focused on the final three games of the season.
There's a lot of guys who are really disappointed because of the missed opportunity that we had. And at the same time, there's a lot of great leaders in that locker room that understand we got a lot of football in front of us.
And that includes playing Tampa Bay twice in the next 3 weeks. First at home on Sunday at Bank of America Stadium. The Panthers are tied 7-7 for first place in the NFC South with Tampa Bay. Mary, Any prediction?
Well, maybe they just wanted more drama, but they can ease their way in. All they have to do is beat the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who they're tied with at the head of the division, NFC South, here at home, and then in a couple of weeks in Tampa Bay. And in between, I think they play the really good Seahawks that just beat the Rams. So they don't have an easy shot, but they're in control of their own destiny at this point.
Eli?
The Panthers seem congenitally unable to win when they're favored, mm-hmm. so we need to just tell them that they are huge underdogs and nobody expects them to beat Tampa Bay, and then they'll do it.
Meanwhile, we never get to the story about the Charlotte to Douglas Airport saying they're expecting less holiday traffic. Why?
Quick. Economic uncertainty.
It'll probably still be a disaster anyway. So
okay. And they are hiring more people. They are bringing more people online to help with less holiday traffic. I don't know. Okay, we're done. Eli Portillo from WFAE, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.